Calvin Coolidge, president of the United States from 1923 to 1929, and so famously taciturn that he became known as Silent Cal. If Silent Cal could speak, what would the president who left the federal government smaller than when he took office say to us today? Amity Schles, author of the new best-selling biography, Coolidge, is here to let us know. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge, now appearing on the website of The Wall Street Journal. I'm Peter Robinson. The author of a syndicated column for the Bloomberg View, Amity Schles directs the 4% growth project at the George W. Bush Presidential Center. She is the author of a number of books, including the best-selling history of the Great Depression, The Forgotten Man. Amity's new book is entitled simply Coolidge. Amity Schles, welcome.
Thank you.
If he could speak, quoting to you, Coolidge, when in 1929 the 30th president climbed onto a train at Union Station to head back home to Massachusetts after his 67 months in office, the federal government was smaller than when he had become president in 1923. Very briefly, think of this as the overture. The curtain is about to rise in a moment. This is the overture. If Silent Cal could speak to us today, what would he say?
Cut some more.
All right. The rise of Calvin Coolidge. Coolidge, you begin the early paragraph about his boyhood and family with this sentence, they were the ones who stayed. Explain that.
Coolidge came from Vermont. It's a very hilly place. It's hard to farm there, and they were farmers. The little town he came from, Plymouth Notch, it was later determined not a single acre of that town, that space, was arable, and they were trying to eke something out of, from the land. A lot of Vermonters left. About half of Vermont left and went west where the land is more generous. But Coolidge's direct ancestors stayed and worked the land in the hard way.
And what did it mean? How did it inform Calvin Coolidge's thinking and character to grow up in a hard place, a small town, in the last quarter of the 19th century?
Well, money was scarce. You thought about it before you spent something. His father was the small squire in the small town, like a selectman, the collector of the snow tax, the one who hired the school teacher in Plymouth Notch, tiny place where the railroad chose not to go. Where they were isolated. They found themselves isolated. So Coolidge saw, his father also ran the store, what it was when someone didn't have enough money to pay and how much it cost and what if you couldn't buy a harness. And he saw also a lot of hardship and death. It's cold in Vermont. Their mode of transport was the sleigh in the winter, and they had a winter hearse that was a sleigh because people tend to die in winter in the 19th century, tuberculosis. And his mother did die while he was a child.
When he was 12, as I recall.
His mother died while he was a child, and so did later his sister, probably of appendicitis. So he experienced much death before graduation from high school.
All right, so he grows up witnessing, experiencing life on the hard margin. Amherst College, down in Massachusetts, and Professor Charles Garman. He falls under the spell, as so many of us do when we go to college, of a dynamic professor. What did Charles Garman mean to the thinking of Calvin Coolidge?
Well, you want to imagine a young man who nearly always fails. So he nearly didn't get into Amherst. He didn't have great grades. And he nearly didn't make it at Amherst because Coolidge was shy. But gradually, professors, especially this Garman, began to draw him out. And he started to speak in class, give public speeches. So Garman was the teacher who taught Coolidge he could be more. And that's always the one we remember. I think, frankly, the other professors lectured to the kids. And then when they got in Garman's class, it was a seminar. And that is also wonderful when that happens junior and senior year, and the teacher cared what they said. One of the things Garman taught that's important is to young people are very anxious when they get out of college. That life is a river. And all you have to do is get in the river, stay in the swim, and go along and not be sidelined, not be stuck on the banks. And eventually you'll become a man of power. You'll have. And this was enormously reassuring to the seniors, Coolidge included, to hear this. And he wrote of this, this memory of what this philosophy professor Garman taught.
Now, so hardscrabble upbringing, death all around, almost doesn't get into Amherst, does so. Slowly unfolds, but then something remarkable happens. If you look at the next roughly quarter century, the ascent is steady. He goes across the river from Amherst to Northampton, Massachusetts, and becomes a lawyer. At the age of 26, he becomes a city councilman. Then, over the next 20 years, he becomes a city solicitor, clerk of courts, state representative, Northampton mayor, state senator, Senate president, lieutenant governor, and in 1918, still only 46 years old, not yet a man of 50, he becomes the governor of Massachusetts. From that hard, humble, difficult beginning, you wouldn't really guess that a few chapters later you'd be reading about the governor of Massachusetts. How did this ascent take place?
I think you might guess, because the Coolidges were always a little bit in government. They were the kind of family where someone went in government and then came out. They believed that was right. You return to the plow. It's corrupting to stay in government too long. So there was a Carlos Coolidge who was governor of Vermont, where he was born. His father was a lawmaker. His grandfather was a lawmaker in the state capital in Vermont. And Coolidge thought, well, I'll go along and do some. He never saw it as very grand. And the reason he was popular, though, in Massachusetts as a young lawmaker was that he always underpromised. He'd go to a constituent, I might do that, and then he would, and over-delivered. So it's the opposite of politicians today. And he cared a lot about the constituents. He would say, I want your vote, I need your vote, and I'm grateful for your vote. Incredible civility and no spin, zero spin. And they like that. And I would mention he was especially popular then as now. The Republican Party was desperate to get the ethnic vote. There were polls and so on, new Irish in Massachusetts, just as he's proceeding in his career. And he was especially good at getting the ethnic vote because he cared about these new constituencies. If someone was a brewer, well, then he might not like prohibition. Coolidge understood that because being a brewer is a business.
Right.
So he let the new arrivals know he understood their ambition in the United States.
Coolidge, quote, in the Massachusetts Senate, his crowning achievement was killing a tax on stocks at the last minute by masterfully exercising the Senate president's privilege to create a tie vote, close quote. Killing a bill, a crowning achievement. Give us the political philosophy that sees that as a crowning achievement.
Well, one could translate it to medicine, Peter. First, do no harm. But Coolidge, imagine a young man comes into politics in the progressive era where you're supposed to make what do progressives like to do. And remember, his party were the progressives, the Republicans.
Right.
They make
Theodore
laws.
Theodore Roosevelt was a progressive.
Right.
Then Woodrow Wilson is president while Coolidge is president of the Massachusetts State Senate. If I have the years exactly
right.
Teens,
right? So progressives like to make laws. They make a lot of laws, and we quantified the number of laws each year expanded in the Massachusetts Senate. And Coolidge gradually became allergic to that. He said, "Well, give administration a chance to catch up with legislation. Too many laws. Be brief. Above all, be brief." And what he was picking up was government for the sake of government isn't always beneficial for the constituents. It just makes everyone feel good. And there's a wonderful letter to his father that the Calvin Coolidge Memorial Foundation published, the letters to his father, where he says, his father's being a little lawmaker in Vermont, and Coolidge, the young son who's now a bigger lawmaker in Massachusetts, writes to his father, it's better to kill a bad bill than to pass a good one. And that's very counterintuitive today, but he saw himself as protecting the voter.
1919, he's governor of Massachusetts. Boston policemen go on strike. There's looting. There's violence. Coolidge, as governor, first tries a conciliatory approach. and it doesn't work. They stay out on strike. What happened next?
Well, you want to imagine the tension of this scene. The policemen were Irish. We just said the Irish voted for Coolidge. He had an election coming up, a new gubernatorial, that very autumn. This is the summer, end of summer. Right. The policemen were hungry or poor. They actually deserved a raise. The rats were chewing on the leather of their helmets in the dirty old station houses. Their horses were, etc. So they had a lot of reasons to, a lot of grievances. But when they went on strike, they abandoned their posts. There was terrible chaos in Boston. They had to call out the state guard, and stores were looted. And Coolidge's...
They had to. Coolidge called out the state guard
mm-hmm. as governor. By an oddity of Massachusetts law, the Boston police force reports through a chain of command to a police commissioner and then up to the governor. So this is all going on. And I think the policemen thought they would win. Wilson, the president, liked public sector unions, maybe. They weren't affiliated with the communists or anything. They were affiliated with the nice AFL, which President Wilson liked, Sam Gompers. But when this all ensued, Governor Coolidge wrote a telegram to Gompers. There is no right to strike against the public safety by anyone, anywhere, anytime. And the policemen were fired by him and through his deputy, through the police. And it was terrible. It was terrible for him. He became sick. It was terrible for the policeman. It was terrible for the police horses who whinnied after their masters. There's stories about this when the policeman went away. But it was an important signal. Maybe the public sector shouldn't strike. Maybe a public sector is different from the private sector. Maybe public sector strike hurt the towns and cities. And why this mattered was that Coolidge, as governor, drew a line in the sand, and he upstaged a sitting president, effectively, because Wilson was waffling. Right. And the country looked to Coolidge. Sometimes we'll look
this
to a
governor. This one event makes him suddenly
this
famous.
This one event that he dared to do this. And what we try to capture in the book is the incredible tension over it, because it's hard to be mean, but sometimes it's necessary.
And he took no pleasure in this.
He took none, and he would always get sick when he did these things. Very human, and he got bad bronchitis. He'd weak lungs, and he didn't think he'd win the election. You'd see, but he did. Massachusetts put him back in office after this.
So get us from that event to running mate with Warren G. Harding.
Well, that put him on the stage. He even writes in his autobiography, which I recommend, and you can see some of this material at the Coolidge Foundation in Plymouth mm-hmm. Notch if you ever visit there. That put him on the stage. He wrote about it. Without a doubt, I think he said, this put me on the national stage. So he wants to run for president, but he doesn't get to. There was a kind of awful, bossy senior senator from Massachusetts, Henry Cabot Lodge. Lodge wasn't so sure he was going to back this upstart governor. Remember, Coolidge was not from Boston, and Bostonians are very snobby. Coolidge was just kind of some swamp Coolidge, as far as Lodge was concerned, out from the west, right. Western Mass, and he really didn't back him. So Coolidge got to be vice presidential candidate with Warren Harding, a very lovable, ebullient, calm, it's a good feeling candidate from senator from Ohio, and they ran on a ticket, a very interesting ticket on normalcy. So when we look in our books and our children take the AP test and so on normalcy, the impression one takes away is normalcy means be stupid, right? Be dumb, be normal. Well, we don't like creativity, but normalcy I discovered in researching this book, had an interesting meaning at the time. What they meant was, let the environment be normal so commerce may thrive.
This is all of this, of course, the campaign is taking place in 1920, and in the background is the First World War.
That's right.
So debt has been run up, young men have been off fighting. Now it's time to get back to norm, to the business.
It's very similar to the current situation where you had a big crisis, in their case, World War I. The debt is higher than anyone ever imagined it would be. They've gone to many billions instead of just a few. The budget is out of control. Taxes are already in the 70s. They can't go higher. There's inflation, but the government isn't acknowledging it, and there's high unemployment. So all this is going on, and they're running on, let's get back to normal. Very, very calm.
President Coolidge. Now, I don't want to give short shrift to Warren Harding. You don't. But Harding as president and Coolidge as vice president, we think now of a vice president as a major figure with an office in the West Wing and an official residence up on Massachusetts Avenue. And in those days, it wasn't so. Coolidge stayed in the Willard Hotel, and his principal job was to preside over the Senate when he chose to do so. And he could go literally months, you report, without setting eyes on the sitting president of the United States, Warren Harding. In August 1923, Vice President and Mrs. Coolidge are on a New England retreat, vacation, at his family home, a farmhouse, in Plymouth Notch, Vermont. Coolidge. The night of August 2nd, the Coolidges retired early. They were sleeping when there was a knock. Tell us what happens next.
Yes, and you want to remember that the Hardings, Mrs. Harding, for example, wasn't wild about Coolidge. It wasn't even clear he'd be vice presidential candidate again in 1924. But the knock comes, the news comes. Harding has died. It's rather sudden. And Coolidge hears his father's voice. You want to imagine two lawmakers, a Vermont lawmaker and a Massachusetts lawmaker. And the Massachusetts lawmaker here, Calvin, the voice comes up and he comes down and they have the news. They barely had a telephone. They had just rigged telephones up. And in the end, he calls around in the middle of the night. Few people are there. And his father swears him in. His father is a notary by that authority. And someone says later to Father Coolidge, what gave you the sense it was okay that you could swear your son in? Nobody told me it wasn't all right. And this is very American. A lot of what happens in the U.S., man to man, that's where commerce lives. That's where our civics live, in our interactions with other people, not always with Grand Washington. So it was extremely Coolidge that this happened. And, of course, this has been painted.
Farmhouse, no electricity, takes place by gaslight. Telephone service only a couple of hours a day at that stage to the farmhouse up in Plymouth Notch.
And suddenly Coolidge is president. And when they call Henry Cabot Lodge to let him know Harding has died, what? Coolidge is president? Oh, my God. His Amherst roommates. Amherst is a theme in this book. Amherst plays a wonderful role. His Amherst buddies, they couldn't believe it. Amherst made it to the White House, and they all did love Calvin. So it was a momentous moment for the country, for the family, for the towns.
Once again, Coolidge. He takes a train from Vermont to head back to Washington, now the President of the United States. Quote, as the train rolled, Coolidge began to write his plan for the presidency. He had to finish what Harding had started, to prove that the First World War period had been an interlude, to take the country back to a time of smaller national government. As Coolidge left Vermont, he put it simply, I believe I can swing it, he said. Did he swing it?
Oh, he certainly did. So this is the great issue. You know that when he came in, they thought he was a lame duck. Well, I mean, every political hand will reckon August 1923. Well, how many months till the general election?
It was November 1924.
Right. Well, just over a year. So they start doing that, right? And it's not sure Congress really likes him so much. He didn't have a very good time in the Senate as president, in part because Lodge sabotaged him. Everyone has a, a bane of his existence in Washington.
Jerk, right?
That's the way Washington is. And yet he through his cunning, his extensive political knowledge. Remember, Coolidge is a professional politician. Today we tend to say that's bad. We're cynical about it. But he was that rare thing, a professional politician who used his mastery to make government smaller instead of bigger. So he said, I'm going to follow Harding policy to perfection. He wrote that to the owner of the Washington Post in order to finish, as Lyndon Johnson say, with Kennedy, what had been started. But what that meant was cut the government back, cut taxes. And you can see him very well operating from the beginning. People thought he'd say no more saving. Harding had saved quite a bit. He said, I am for economy, Coolidge did. And after that, I'm for more economy. He was quite aggressive coming out of the box. And that, of course, set people aback. And he, when he finally did give a speech saying all he would do, which was towards the end of the year, basically a State of the Union, he made it clear he would stake his presidency on smaller government, including vast tax cuts. So that was dramatic and brave.
This first period of a year, 10 months, maybe 14 months, depending on how you count it, is actually an astonishing performance. It would have been entirely acceptable. Everyone would have believed that Calvin Coolidge of Vermont and Massachusetts had done his duty if he had simply been a gracious caretaker of the remaining months of the Harding presidency and then gone home to Massachusetts. And instead, he's aggressive.
He's a warrior.
And you mentioned the way Johnson fulfilled Kennedy's program. As I myself at least read those years, Johnson did it for political reasons. Kennedy was the slain hero. You had to do what the hero had laid out as his next few tasks. Coolidge, there's an intellectual commitment. He really believes that Harding was doing what needed to be done. And so he feels some affection to Harding. Harding, the country mourns Harding. But in some basic way, Harding's program was also Coolidge's. Is that fair?
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, specifically, Coolidge didn't like the word normalcy. He was a stickler for English. It kind of, something that he said, less economic uncertainty. Mm. So tax-wise, that was reduce, change the law, make it simpler, and reduce the rates. And one of the fabulous things about him for business school to study is his masterful delegation. So who's the Treasury Secretary? Someone very talented, Andrew Mellon. A Wall Streeter, a Pittsburgher Wall
right.
Street, someone who knows about finance.
Steel and finance. This is a titan of American
It's like
industry.
A Warren Buffett.
Right,
or,
right.
Or, Mellon says we must cut taxes more, and if we cut the rates, Mellon was quite a big thinker, we might get more revenue, Mr. President, because right now we have a tax strike. We might get more revenue. And you can imagine Coolidge, temperamentally a saver, this is a book about debt, was quite uneasy with this concept of cutting rates because he was a budgeteer to the extreme. And he was uncomfortable because if you cut the tax rate, well, you might not get the revenue and then you'd have a deficit. He balanced the budget. He didn't have no deficit. But if you cut the rates and you did get more revenue, well, that was bad too because those progressives would spend it in Congress.
Right.
So you want to imagine a fundamental discomfort with the tax cut idea. And yet Coolidge overcame that for two reasons. One was if Mellon said it was necessary, he should back Mellon up. And two, his sense that high taxes were immoral because they abridged freedom. And if you go on YouTube, you can see wonderful videos of Coolidge giving speeches about this. Well, it takes away. It's legalized larceny. The rates were still high in the 50s. Let's get down to 25.
Right.
That's even lower than Reagan. So those two reasons and this pair campaigned mightily for these tax cuts.
Coolidge, once again, your book. Under Coolidge, the federal debt fell. Under Coolidge, the top income tax came down by half to 25%. Under Coolidge, the federal budget was always in surplus. Under Coolidge, unemployment was 5% or even down to 3%. Under Coolidge, the economy grew strongly even as the federal government shrank, close quote. But you know, Amity, that Coolidge doesn't deserve any of the credit for that. That was just the release of pent-up wartime demand.
Well, that's a standard interpretation. But there was pent-up wartime demand in the early 20s, and yet there was unemployment and trouble. It was important about Coolidge was that he said, I'll get out of the way. He didn't say, they spoke a different economic language. And one reason this book was fun to write and one reason I did write it was it behooves us all to know what they thought about how an economy works because they were different. And he thought if commerce were free and there were austerity in government, if government pulled back and commerce were free, commerce, he didn't say the economy, he said commerce would grow. And it appears he was right. So the people, it wasn't just pent-up demand. Of course, there's demand for new stuff. People wanted to buy a car, but it was supply. What makes a company want to start another company?
Right.
And what makes someone want to have an idea? And you can see this demand has very little to do with patents.
Right.
Patents are what make productivity gains. So to put this in regular language, people used to work Saturdays. But when we had all these new ideas from the assembly line on, and then we were able to implement them with capital, then people could get a good salary and they got their Saturday. So you want to think of Coolidge as a man who gave us Saturday.
All right.
Free day.
One anomaly here. Although he's a champion of free markets, Coolidge is generally favorable to tariffs. Explain that one.
Well, Coolidge was a party man. That's what's intriguing about him, too. There were the show of independence that we require of any politician now was not there. And the party was for tariffs. Tariffs were...
Going all the way back to Lincoln.
Going back a while, yes. And tariffs were wrong. We know they were wrong. There was a fundamental...
You better just explain what a tariff was. It's so out of...
Absolutely. So it's a tax on anything sold by another country. So a foreign car maker will send his car over here and we put a tax on it so he can't sell as many cars as Mr. Ford. This would be very, for example, Coolidge is from New England, woolens. And this summer at Plymouth Notch, Vermont, we're going to have a varsity high school economic debate about tariffs.
Oh, nice.
And the Coolidges were all the way for tariffs. Why? From his childhood. They sold sugar from their maple trees. Well, if the Cubans could sell sugar, then the Coolidge sugar wouldn't sell. And then the Coolidges couldn't buy a harness. They would have no money, that same issue. So I was interested to see why the Republicans might be for tariffs in this period. And in researching this book, Peter, I discovered something. One is that Coolidge's friends all told him, don't be for tariffs, be for free markets. His Amherst intellectual friends, like Dwight Morrow of Wall Street. But the other was there was a political reason for tariffs. The mill owner said, there will be strikes unless I can pay more. And after World War I, there was enormous ruction in this country. It wasn't like Occupy Wall Street. It was much worse. Whole cities were occupied. And the head of the mill would come to the government and say, I would like calm at my mill. If I could pay more, well, then I would have calm. But I can only pay more if I have no competition from Australia. So this is the political context of tariffs. They're wrong economically, but there was a political context.
Right. Coolidge on immigration. At least a cursory reading of the record looks as though he's anti-immigrant.
Oh, not at all.
All right.
Not at all. I mean, it relates to our immigration debate, too.
Right.
The most famous Coolidge line is when he's talking about immigration. He says, whether we came over on the Mayflower a long time ago or in steerage just now, we're all in the same boat here.
Nice
We're
line.
All in the same boat here.
Nice and he could write, couldn't he?
He could write better. You know, as a writer, one doesn't want to compete with him because he's the poet and he's the minister in a way.
Right.
So if you look at his calendar, and we did this for this book, we studied his calendars. He would be, you know, visiting the home culture club. He would be calling on the immigrant group. He'd be working all the time. He was very interested in assimilation, by which he meant immigrants learning English and learning civics in the United States. You can choose to perceive that as kind of, I don't know, culturally offensive, that he would want to Americanize. They used words like that. I think it's great. Because what he was saying was the immigrants here, in order to appreciate the country and contribute to it, have to know what it is.
So the Coolidge rule on immigration is pretty simple. Come to America if you're here to work and if you want to become American.
If you want to become American. But by which he didn't mean get rid of your whole culture. What he meant was in the public sphere, on the town common, we talk English, we honor property rights, we know a little bit of the history. On immigration law itself, he signed a law reducing immigration in part because of the great unrest that we described before with the strike. There was a lot of unrest, and a lot of it was soldiers and immigrants who were watching Europe and Ireland. There was a revolution, right?
He did believe when it came to immigration in a kind of resting period.
That's right. But to paint him as anti-foreign is to...
That's false.
It's false.
Just plain wrong.
It's absolutely wrong.
Character, Coolidge. From the start, in the Hamlet of Plymouth Notch to his death in 1933, he died what now strikes me as young, older and older ages strike me as younger and younger. He died at 60. From Plymouth Notch to his death in 1933, Calvin Coolidge did confront challenges. The acres he inherited were more rock and hill than dirt. Death visited Coolidge constantly. Coolidge himself was always so sickly that both his father and he worried that he might never complete his education. And to an improbable event, The chapters of Coolidge's life after childhood are chapters of near failure upon near failure. Actually, so defend that last assertion, because again, you look at this and wait a moment, he's governor of Massachusetts at 46, and by 48, he's vice president of the United States. That doesn't sound like near failure after near failure.
Well, he was not without cunning. And, you know, politicians, we talked about he liked to be understated. So you see this snapshot, Coolidge almost failed, and then somehow he wins. And, you know, there was an editorial that won a Pulitzer Prize called Who Made Calvin Coolidge? And it quoted all the things people said, how that lucky son of a gun, Coolidge, well, the Massachusetts Republican Party made him, or, you know, the accident of the tragic death of Harding made him. And the conclusion of this editorial said, no, only Coolidge made Coolidge. It was partly an act. He was very certain and very ambitious. But it was hard for him, and that makes him very human. Right.
So here's the contrast then. Robert Caro, Lyndon Johnson's biographer, draws a connection between the hardships that Johnson experienced growing up on the Pedernales River, 50 or 60 miles west of Austin. Very similar, although decades later, of course, but very similar in many ways. The land was poor, the soil was rocky. There was no electricity. It was a hard life. And Caro draws a direct connection from Lyndon Johnson's hardscrabble upbringing in Texas to his championing the federal government as an instrument for lifting the poor of the nation. And Amity Schlaes says in Coolidge, well, Calvin Coolidge had a hardscrabble, difficult upbringing as well. And he reached exactly the opposite conclusion. Limit that federal government, keep it restrained, and let the people take care of themselves. Why that contrast? What do you make of it?
It was his own experience. He saw that commerce improved things. He was a great, very modern in his scholarship of networks. So the single tragedy of his town was so the railroad went everywhere else. It didn't go to Plymouth. It was left out of the network, out of the Facebook, right?
Off the grid.
Off the grid, right? Off the grid. And he went to Northampton and he saw Northampton was a county seat, commerce, and the trolley business was just getting up. And you could take the trolley to Amherst where he went to college, the trolley and the train and how many trains. And he saw the value of networks and connection. Very modern thinker. And later, he was a great champion of aviation because airplanes connected people. So I think it was his economic analysis. He understood very well that commerce improved things. They improved things for the Coolidges, too. The town was hard scrabble. His family didn't have a lot of money, but they weren't totally poor. Mm-hmm. They had farmland in the background. They had the stores. Father had many bank accounts here and there. They were just savers. So Coolidge saw that if you make a choice, which does better for the people on balance? Coolidge made his choice, and he said commerce does better for the people than government over the longer run.
Grace Goodhue, vivacious, charming, beautiful. I still remember there's a portrait of her in the White House. Full-length portrait, extremely elegant woman, beautifully dressed, standing, as I recall, next to a Borzoi dog. I mean, just a picture of elegance. How did he persuade Grace Goodhue to become Mrs. Calvin Coolidge?
Well, they met in Northampton. She taught the deaf. Mm-hmm. She was a professional. And in that way, she's like Laura Bush. She had a trade when she came to her marriage, and she was quite devoted to it. I work now at the Bush Presidential Center. And in a way, they're similar. So imagine someone whose profession was bringing out people. When you teach the deaf, that's hard. And then here was this very silent but very accomplished lawyer. And it's a wonderful marriage to follow. He could be hard on Grace. It's not a modern marriage. For example, he didn't allow her to ride horses in the White House. He thought it was unseemly for the First Lady. In this picture that you described, Coolidge was quite jealous of his wife, protective. We describe some tensions in the book. The doggy is white, and Grace is wearing a stunning red dress. And Coolidge saw the red dress in the painting. And does the dress really have to be red? It's a little loose. And the painter said, well, to set off the dog. And Coolidge's reply was, well, why don't you paint the dog red? And she could wear white. He liked Grace to wear white. And in the White House, they lost a son. That was a very big tragedy.
That's the next question, because you've got Calvin Coolidge Jr. Wouldn't have happened with modern antibiotics. He's playing tennis on the White House court. He develops a blister. And a week later, he's dead of sepsis, not long after his 16th birthday. And one historian, Robert Gilbert, wrote a book called The Tormented President, in which he argues that after the death of his son, Calvin Jr., Coolidge falls into a deep depression from which he never really recovers. You don't get that.
Well, Robert Gilbert's book is good. However, I think it's not a story of yes, comma, but, you know, it's but yes. I see Coolidge more like Lincoln. He keeps going after the loss of his son.
He just keeps going.
He continues his campaign. The tax cuts come later. That was his Civil War. It's not always easy, but people do keep going, and he did. I wanted to say about Grace in this tense marriage, right? And she's beautiful, and he's quiet, and she works so hard, of course, as First Lady. Coolidge gave her an incredible gift afterwards. All his friends get around and raise money for his presidential library, just as they do for presidents. We've just done this at the Bush Center. Clarence Barron of the Wall Street Journal raises $2 million for Coolidge, which is then a lot.
Huge sum in those days.
And all along, Coolidge is saying, well, this is for my wife's project, but nobody quite believes him. But Coolidge does take the money at the end, and he doesn't use it for the presidential library of Coolidge. He uses it for his wife's favorite charity, all $2 million, the Clark School for the Deaf. And what a marital gift. Someone serves you. They took turns in the White House. She had to play First Lady. He gave his retirement to his wife. Why? His heart was weak. She was aerobic. Grace Coolidge was very energetic, would clearly live many years. So now she was the most important lady in the town with her charity, a good charity. And I was struck by this marital gift. It must have chagrined the donors.
He was knowingly setting her up.
He set her up for a good life and a meaningful life when he was gone.
And she lived until?
She lived into the 50s, I believe.
At least 20 years
old. Yes. So this school did prosper for a long time.
You spent some years on this book. Is Calvin Coolidge good company?
He's fabulous company. He's fabulous. He's quiet, but he's honest. And he always does what he says he will. He abhorred litigation, though he was a lawyer. And he found ways to solve things. And through the Calvin Coolidge Foundation in Plymouth Notch, which I hope everyone will visit, I made some good friends, found some good material. The Forbes Library in Northampton is a wonderful place, too. Julie Nelson is there. And through I made all sorts of friends of Coolidge in my friendship with Coolidge. And all those friends were a bit like Coolidge in their trustworthiness.
Marvelous. Final set of questions, lessons. Let me give you two quotations, Amity, both reviews of the book. In a review of Coolidge, this once again is the book. It's a big book, but it's completely engrossing, and everyone should know that. And I can't hold it up to the camera too often. In a review of Coolidge in the Wall Street Journal, Robert Mary, quote, "The Coolidge years represent the country's most distilled experiment in supply-side economics and the doctrine's most conspicuous success," close quote. In another review of Coolidge, this one in the New York Times, Jacob Heilbrun, quote, "Coolidge's opposition to regulation allowed Wall Street and the banks to engage in rampant speculation and insider trading. He was the preeminent cheerleader for the economic nostrums that led to the crash," close quote. Adjudicate.
Oh, well, Mr. Mary is correct.
All right.
It was what modern supply-siders would call a supply-side experiment, what Coolidge and Mellon did with taxes, although they emphasized debt, too. Coolidge had twin lion cubs, and they were the same weight. And one was called Budget Bureau, and the other was called...
He literally had lion cubs.
Some
diplomat gave him two
baby
lions. Exactly.
The mayor of Johannesburg gave him these lion cubs. But they weren't, of course, pets after a while. He named one Budget Bureau and the other Tax Reduction. And he didn't have a big old lion called Tax Reduction and a little weeny runt called Budget Bureau. He kept them the same weight. They were twins. So that's not a modern supply side. Modern supply siders tend to emphasize the tax and the growth first. But yes, he was the hero of supply siders. And
supply side means you cut the taxes growth can sometimes be so robust that you end up even with more revenues after you cut your taxes.
More revenues than you expected. And the evidence is there in the statistics of income for the 20s for anyone to see.
But what about this persistent charge that the 20s were a period of giddy indebtedness and a slowly inflating bubble that in the 1929 crash popped, and then we get the Great Depression for a decade and a half afterwards. We paid a heavy price for Silent Cal.
Well, if I were Silent Cal, to answer that, I'd go monosyllabic and say no. But to get to the detail, every president has some blame for what follows him, but Coolidge didn't have much. It's a bit extreme to say there was no SEC at that time. So the SEC didn't manage.
Securities and Exchange Commission.
Couldn't manage any stock market. The stock market was in New York. And the New York State and the stock market itself was in charge of itself.
He felt ill at ease, though,
toward
the final years of the
20s. Of course, but he had to choose between two things. One is your own discomfort, and he spelled this out very well in a discussion, for example, with Charles Merrill, who founded Merrill Lynch.
Yes.
I'm uncomfortable with it. You can see it in his stock purchases, which I have in the book. I think the market's too high. It was too high. It was definitely too high. I went to 381 eventually after he left from 100. But if the president and the federal government take over the stock market, that will set a bad precedent that may hurt the economy later. And in Forgotten Man, to which this is the prequel, I argue, well, the government messed with the economy in the 30s, and that's what made it great, not the 20s. And there's plenty of evidence for that.
Once again, two quotations. Coolidge. Knowing the details of Coolidge's life may help Americans now. That's quotation one. Quotation two, Thomas Mallon's review of Coolidge in The New Yorker. What good can Coolidge's policies do us now? The budget wars in Schley's book feel like fantastically small-scale skirmishes in comparison with those currently being fought. In Coolidge's time, the nation had not yet piled high its commitments to the sick and to the poor and to the old. Close quote. Calvin Coolidge could do what he did because he was operating on an almost flea circus-sized stage. And the federal government today is so much more massive, and rightly so, because it's taken obligations to the underprivileged, to the poor, to the needy.
Well, I saw more analogy than Mr. Mallon. Remember, coming out of World War I, we had a progressive movement that wanted to nationalize power that was to the left of where our parties are today, take over the railroad maybe, and the progressives were on the march. Everyone thought they were the future.
There was even a sizable socialist party
in
those days.
This tax campaign was important because it said, well, we want to be smaller. We think we can do it. And I think it's important for the viewer to know that Coolidge won on this policy resoundingly because the sort of idea is that, well, you can never win if you say you're going to cut. Either party says that now, right? Coolidge won. He beat the progressives, got 17% of the vote in 1924. Sizable. Right. The Democrats got the vote, but Coolidge won on a policy of saving government austerity, an absolute majority, more than the other two parties combined. Wow, and he would at the party at a
nerve. It was a three-party race.
Three-party
in
race,
24.
And he prevailed, and then
he won
in
an absolute majority.
Absolute majority, very rare. Usually there's a split, right? And then in 28, when he chose not to run, wow, the party had a nervous breakdown. The Republican Party, because he was so immensely popular. When you get to a crisis situation, as with Mrs. Thatcher in Britain, all of a sudden savers are attractive. And what Coolidge is a model for when we get to a crisis situation, we want to recall him. I find him absolutely modern.
All right. A couple more questions, final questions. The people who've sat where you're sitting right now in recent months include former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, Congressman and former vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. And in a couple of weeks, we'll be interviewing Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, every one of them a plausible and maybe even a likely presidential candidate. What specific lessons, what policy prescriptions should they take from President Coolidge?
Debt comes first. The federal government can't always have a big debt. That's completely against what the current politics says, but the debt will matter. He cared about debt, and in reducing the debt, he made America stable. tax cuts are okay and that government austerity is not a bad thing. It could be a good thing.
There's sequester away.
Sequester away. It could be a good thing. And you want to define government austerity as separate from personal austerity.
Final question. You sit on the Calvin Coolidge Memorial Foundation, and although Coolidge was the last president not to leave a presidential library, you mentioned that he gave that money to his wife's, to the Clark School for the Deaf, his wife's favorite charity. He and his family did, in effect, preserve the little hamlet of Plymouth Notch, Vermont, one of my favorite places in the country. Why should every American in the year 2013, deep into the 21st century, wish to visit Plymouth Notch? What is there to see and what is there to learn about this little town preserved in a declivity in the Vermont mountains from the 19th century?
It's up a steep hill. It's small houses. Coolidge wasn't born over the store, but he was born behind it. You can see that, see the counterpane he made. Visit the state of Vermont has a beautiful exhibit. So you get a feel of how small it was. And what Coolidge saw, it was beautiful, but it was too removed. We see the lime kiln lot where his family collected.
The lime kiln lot is one of the lots of the ground around Plymouth Notch is divided up into lots.
Right, where they collected where they got their maple sugar,
right,
the syrup. I just think it's a wonderful visit. We're having, there's a dinner August 2, and we hope people will come. That's the anniversary of the big swearing in, August 2, 3. Hope right. People will come and hear Brian Lamb will be presiding at the dinner. The Bush Center, where I work, and the Coolidge Foundation are doing this together. Presidents and economics, presidential economic debates there at Plymouth Notch with high schoolers who are coming over from a clinic to learn about Coolidge. So this will be a wonderful event. So always go to Plymouth Notch. Always study it. Take your children there. Visit the cheese factory. I forgot to mention that. Coolidge's father's cheese factory.
And tell us about, in the Little Plymouth Notch graveyard, the vast marble mausoleum in which the 30th President of the United States is laid to rest, this elaborate structure with which they celebrate him.
Yes, in the back of the book, I have a picture of the cemetery when he was sadly buried. You go along looking for the presidential grave and you don't find it because it's not that different from his father's, is it? This is the Coolidge humility. He preserved the presidency by respecting it, but not by aggrandizing himself.
Amity Schles, author of Coolidge. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson.